Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you. The phone lines are open and you can reach us at 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, use that number, 941-3689. Or from the neighbor islands or just about anywhere else, 877-941-3689. Last week was an intense and pivotal one for Honolulu's homeless. The sit-lay bans passed the city council. The plan to use 5 Sand Island acres as a tent encampment passed both the council and the Hawaii Board of Land and Natural Resources. The facility is positioned as a 2-year project funded with Housing First monies. That's only part of the plan that's drawn fire. Tonight on Town Square, we'll get a community response to Honolulu's plans to help the homeless and whether those plans are in sync with the state's. We'll look at best practices with Matthew Daugherty, the Director of Initiatives for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. He's here this week. Jenny Lee, staff attorney at the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, and Catherine Jian, the Executive Director of Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, and you too. We want to hear from you about how you assess the city's handling of those who are homeless. And a program note, we did invite the city's managing director, Ember Shin, to participate, and we were told that the city felt it had already shared its position during a recent segment on The Conversation and had nothing more to add. So welcome to all of you who are here, and thanks for making time this evening.
Thank you.
With what we saw happen over in the last week in particular, there's a lot of concern that maybe we are looking at the very wrong way of handling this with those who are homeless and that there are some inherent problems with Sand Island. But first, before we begin to take that apart a little bit, as you look out over the general picture, I want to go right around the table and say, what do you see that may be working since the last time we had this conversation together? And I'll start with you, Jenny.
I think that the city has adopted entirely the right track by focusing on housing first, as well as releasing an assertive, affordable housing strategy last week that unfortunately was overshadowed by the Sand Island encampment proposal. But I think those are the two fundamental means. Everybody needs housing to end homelessness, and then we also need the appropriate interventions, which are focused around the housing first approach.
I think that the recent statements by the mayor on increasing affordable housing are fairly progressive and a step in the right direction. However, if they're feasible or not remains to be another question, but I think it's a really large problem he's tackling. For some reason, though, I question whether or not he understands the harm that criminalization efforts do to projects like Housing First, which I feel are diametrically opposed to each other.
Matthew, it's been a little while since we talked to each other when you were here last time and you were on The Conversation. As you see where Hawaii is right now, what kind of progress have you seen or maybe lack of?
Sure. So the last time I was here was in June when the community was coming together to just begin to plan how we would implement a coordinated assessment for people experiencing homelessness. So moving towards a standardized approach for how to assess people's needs and then to identify what are the most appropriate housing and services interventions to address those needs and to end people's homelessness. In the couple of months since I've been here, since I was last here, the community has made a great deal of progress in moving that system forward. They've performed nearly 1,000 assessments of people experiencing homelessness. They have much deeper and richer data about the kinds of assistance that people need, the challenges that people face. They have the tools and the data now to really start to make the case for what kinds of resources need to be invested. And a key part of that is permanent supportive housing focused on those people who are experiencing chronic homelessness and the city's efforts to invest into the creation of new permanent supportive housing units is key to the success that's possible here. And then a much greater understanding of the percentage of the population that needs a shorter-term intervention and rapid rehousing strategies and having the data now to begin to make the case for how should state and local resources start to prioritize investments into those kinds of interventions.
You've all sort of touched on or alluded to the Haleomalama data that has been collected and the number of people who have been able to be triaged where they are. Is there any more that you think that needs to happen that could better happen in other places other than where people meet up with those who are homeless? Should there be some sort of central place where this is done as the city is proposing in some ways with Sand Island?
I would say that from my perspective, and I'm not a direct service provider, but I do serve as an advocacy committee co-chair for Partners in Care, which is a coalition of Oahu's homeless service providers. Caveat, I'm not speaking here on behalf of them, but just saying that I do am familiar with some of the work. And I think that it appears to be extremely successful. Matthew can speak more specifically to the Haole Omalama numbers, but they're almost at 900 people that have been assessed. And these are some of the most difficult to reach clients. And they've done it very successfully. They have great street outreach teams that go to meet clients where they are, work with them repeatedly, and then are able to complete these assessments. Other good examples are where they're able to work with shelters, missions like River of Life, be able to, again, just really put people in a position where they can build those relationships of trust and then identify their needs, their level of vulnerability. Since that's already going on throughout the island, it is it seems entirely ineffective and a poor use of funds to create what they're referring to now as a triage site on Sand Island. All that great work is already being done in the community.
And that's where a great deal of the criticism has come, too, that why would you move people from point A to point B to be able to do the same thing that you can do where they are and to meet them where they are, which might be a lot easier anyway. Matthew, go ahead.
I think the key goal needs to be, how do we create the most effective and efficient pathways to move people from the experience of homelessness into housing? And in some communities, they focus on centralized facilities where they have multiple agencies on site, so that becomes a bit of a one-stop center. But centralizing the resources isn't really the key. The key is that the services and programs begin to function and think like a system, so that across all of the agencies and programs, they're using the same kind of approach to assessing need, and they're not just determining whether someone should be eligible for their program and services, but they are then using that information to determine where within the system is that service and resource available for that individual or household. And so it's less about centralization. It needs to be more about coordination of effort and standardizing the approach to how we end people's homelessness. And so the Haole Omalama effort is very much about that coordination of effort and starting to move the community to have a set of programs and agencies that are functioning like a system rather than just an individual array of programs.
So if you had to peg where we are now in that level of coordination, where are we?
Making significant progress, but it's still a long ways to go. That there still needs to be more effort to identify what are the resources that can address the needs that now there's more data to understand, and is there a standardized approach to meeting those needs? So is the entire community of providers moving towards a housing-first strategy? One of the things I've noticed on multiple visits to Honolulu and Oahu is that the language of housing-first gets used to talk about permanent supportive housing, and it's a bit of a misuse of the terminology. Housing-first is really about an entire orientation of the system to identifying the quickest and most efficient pathway for any individual or household to get to permanent housing, helping them get there, and wrapping the right array of services, the right intensity of services around them to make sure it's stable. And permanent supportive housing is a key resource, and the best permanent supportive housing operates with housing first principles. So the city needs to make sure as it moves forward with its permanent supportive housing investments that it implements housing first practices to ensure that those who most need that resource are the ones who are prioritized and get access to that housing.
And part of what we've also heard over the last week is that may be threatened if you're going to take people away from Waikiki and put them into a tent encampment, that they may in fact be able to somehow, you know, jump the line of other people who are the most vulnerable and the most in need of having housing first services, as you've just articulated.
And I don't know what the city's operational plans are around that, so I can't speak to whether they're planning that jumping the line approach or not. I can speak that the federal agencies have issued clear guidance to communities about how they should be prioritizing permanent supportive housing. So just within the last month or so, the Department of Housing and Urban Development issued guidance, a notice to continuums of care about the approaches that they should be using to prioritize permanent supportive housing resources. And it very much focuses on assessing those who are most vulnerable, have the most intense needs for services, and that's who should be prioritized. And then it's very clear in how other populations should be prioritized below that population.
And that's the population that Haole Omalama has already been able to detail.
One of the problems that I have with this whole concept of a transitional triage center on Sand Island is that, and this was stated over and over again by the people that I've talked to and also who've come to community meetings, that you don't want to put local residents in a box, especially those who have lost everything and who've been through some pretty horrific raids due to criminalization. that one of the first and foremost thing that it does is it breaks trust. And when you are trying to help somebody, trust is the number one priority. If you don't have that, your client will not listen to you, and they shouldn't. So what does it say to them if we try to shuttle them to a centralized area in Sand Island that could be toxic and won't have the amenities that they would have in their own communities that they have set up in their own encampments that are self-policed by their own people of houseless families with children mostly. They're relegated to a dusty, arid, very hot area that's surrounded by toxic dumps and cargo areas. And you know, it's not a pleasant place. It sends a message that not only are we going to put you in a former internment campsite, but we don't care about you. But we're going to try to convince the public that this is a part of the plan towards permanent housing. It's a little bit more coercive than, you know, we would like things to be run by the government. State-run encampments usually tend not to go very well. And so as a service provider, the issue of trust and that relationship bond that needs to happen before any of these services take place needs to be kept holy.
Matthew, are there any other places in the country that have gone to this kind of model at all and been able to justify it?
I can't really think of any examples in which they've really taken the step to newly create an encampment-type setting on public lands. There are examples in which those settings have been officially authorized or formalized under public funding. My agency, we're clear in our position that we never recommend to communities that they formalize encampments and invest resources and time into creating the sort of semi-permanent.
Because it's temporary by the very nature of it.
That it's not a solution. It doesn't really provide people with better access to permanent housing outcomes. And it becomes a distraction for communities from the real solutions that they need to be investing in. And as I think you've probably experienced over the last week, it becomes the focus for all the conversation and discussion. And there's many other conversations and discussions and strategies that need to be moving forward. And then the settings inherently pose some risk for inhabitants, and it's difficult to manage and create a safe and stable environment for people in those settings. And the resources just effectively would be better spent elsewhere. And at the same time, we're clear to communities that we never recommend that the approach should be to disperse people from settings in which they are currently living, because they often have
other
options to go to. And that it does, as Catherine was indicating, lead to an environment in which there's distrust. It's costly to intervene in those ways. Sometimes many communities have experienced legal issues in how they've dealt with those situations. And it risks further traumatizing people who have experienced a great deal of trauma in their lives. So we're clear that we don't support formal encampments, nor do we support the dispersing of encampments that may currently exist.
If you've just joined us tonight, we're taking a look at homelessness in Honolulu and what the city has been doing, both some of the good things and some of the real issues that have drawn criticism over the last week, and particularly the Sand Island encampment plan. We want to hear from you, too. Our number is 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. It's not a problem that's going away, depending upon what you may think of how we've seen the last week go and various bills that have been passed, Bill 48, all of that. It's just moving. Are we really just moving the problem around? And what do we really need to do to be able to better the lives of many of those who are just down on their luck, need to have someplace better to be? And what's our responsibility to them? We want to hear what you have to say. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Looking at some of the data that Hale Omolama collected, about half of the people that they talk to don't have really serious problems, that they need to have help. They need to be able to get over this really bad bump in their lives. We tend to use the word homeless and look at it as it's one population, even though we have conversations and have had for 15, 20 years that this is not one population, but several different populations. And yet it seems, looking at it from the outside, that we come at it with very similar strategies for all of those populations. Where do you see the strategies changing, if you see them at all, for how we deal with the various populations that we all tend to term homeless? Jenny?
Well, I think that the housing first approach is being a consistent one throughout. That does apply to everybody, whether it's somebody you anticipate needing permanent supportive housing or somebody who has had a medical emergency or faced eviction and ended up in homelessness. And that is predicated on as quickly as possible placing people into permanent housing units, stability, and without the preconditions required to mandate, say, that they're in compliance with a case management plan. So I think that for anybody, that is an applicable strategy. But within that, then, as Matthew mentioned, that the needs do vary across those folks. Some people will need constant supports for the rest of their lives, and other people with adequate financial assistance. So say it might just be first month's rent or 6 months rent assistance while they find employment again. Then those are people who hopefully, and I think we can anticipate, would not return to the cycle of homelessness once they have that stability developed in their lives. So I think it's shifting away for everybody, away from an idea that you go through that continuum of an emergency shelter to transitional housing. And then you only go to permanent housing when you're ready. And that's one of the problems with Sand Island, is the concept of it as a transition center, that it's a place you go to get ready for permanent housing. And that is entirely antithetical to the housing first approach. And it in no way can be called housing first.
I mean, the idea behind it is very simple. You've got to get somebody stabilized in a home that they consider to be a home, and then wrap everything else around them or be able to access them once someone has settled. And you know, a few people who have been caught even between moves who don't know what that feels like to have suddenly, you know, shifting carpet under your feet. We want to hear what you have to say. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about how do we help the homeless, and looking at what's happened over the last week, how do you feel about how the city is approaching those people we term as homeless, the various different populations within that general term. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Catherine.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed in the past few months with this campaign of compassionate disruption was the media discourse that tried to define the community as a whole as usually mentally ill or violent or dirty, and especially from the mainland, which sent a pretty distorted message to the general populace that these are people other than us, that they are people that that we could never identify with. And that's not true. One of the dangers of that discourse going in that direction, which was false, is that you get away from addressing the root cause of the problem here of homelessness, which any of us can fall into, which is how does the state deal with poverty and economy and the distribution, the fair distribution of wealth? Not very good, actually. It took us years to raise our minimum wage, and still it's not significant enough for people to be able to afford their own home. Your average 20-something or 30-something will probably never be able to afford their own home here. And these are the questions that we need to start talking about and solving, because this issue of homelessness shows no signs of slowing down. And if we completely just revolve our discourse around the other, or paint the picture, the erroneous picture that the homeless are outside of our population, then we're never going to solve the issue of homelessness, and we're only going to make that worse.
Your point being that, you know, none of this exists in a vacuum, that they all are related and integrated with each other. And we can't simply myopically train on this part of it and not look at the rest of it. Matthew?
I just wanted to jump in that just a little concern that I don't want to give the impression that there's no indication of progress in ending homelessness, because nationally we are seeing a great deal of progress. And measured by the annual point in time counts between 2010 and 2014, we actually saw a 33% reduction in the number of veterans who are counted as homeless at a given point in time. And why we know that's happening is because we are getting investments of resources into the right kinds of programs. So for veterans, the HUD-VASH program, which provides a supportive housing opportunity, and the Supportive Services for Veteran Families program, which provides a rapid rehousing opportunity for veterans who don't need the intensity of supportive housing. And those resources are being targeted in the right ways and reaching the right people. So we see that when we invest the resources and we use the strategies, we can make real progress and move towards ending homelessness. So it's not a hopeless problem. It's not an intractable problem. It's not necessarily a problem we need to wait to solve all of the other issues that contribute to people being at risk or experiencing housing instability, we can make real progress. We can achieve the goals if we use the right practices and invest in the right strategies.
You just heard from Matthew Daugherty, the Director of Initiatives for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Also around our panel tonight, or around our table, Jenny Lee, Staff Attorney at the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, and Catherine Jean, Executive Director for the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, and you too. And we know we have a lot of callers on the line now. If you want to join the conversation, do it sooner rather than later. We're going to go to our callers now, talking to Bert, calling us from Nu'uanu. Aloha, Bert. Thanks for your patience.
No problem. It's a fascinating conversation that all of us think about in the community. They're impacted by homelessness. And my comment is I totally disagree with the idea of Catherine said that these people are of a different culture or society than us. I deal with the homeless in my neighborhood, and we've come to terms. But we're talking about gentlemen, single gentlemen that live on the street that have no interest in going to a shelter and will never go to a shelter, you know, that's in there due to their, one, assimilation to living outside, and two, their inability to follow the rules that come with a shelter environment. You know, I've had long conversations with them. So what do we do with this population? Because to your point, Bethann, that the homeless are all sorts of different groups. And when you have a group that is hard to help, where do we turn? Do we focus on, you know, my idea, the housing first idea, was to take the most downtrodden, the people that are sick and mentally ill and can't care for themselves first. Is that wrong? Or what is the solution to those who are sick, mentally ill, and will not seek help?
Bert, you're asking a lot of really good questions. Let me see if we can get you a lot of good answers, too. Thanks so much for the call. All right, which part do we want to tackle first? What do we do when you have somebody who, and we've talked about this before, because clearly not everybody is going to get hip to this or want to be part of this. So what do you do when you have someone who is chronically opposed to entering any sort of shelter situation?
Well, I think I agree with Bert in that, you know, I think he misunderstood what I was saying, that these homeless persons aren't very much different than us, but there is there are differences in the population. The chronically homeless who are mentally ill and unstable should be housed first. That's what Housing First is for. However, you know, I caution people about endorsing plans that coerce people into shelter, because there are very good reasons why shelters do not work for people. Take, for instance, the Native Hawaiians. These are the kinds of people that you do not want to put into a box. They do not want to be there. And they have every right to live where they want in this, you know, formerly colonized land. There's a lot of trauma there. And putting them into an institution like a shelter, which does have rules, is a bit unfair. There are other ways to approach populations that do not want to be housed in shelter. You also have to take in consideration that there are abuses that actually happen in shelter, which is why they do not want to go there.
And we've talked to homeless people and people who are directly providing services that many times homeless people will say, hey, if I know I'm going to bed down next to this person or that person and I know who that person is, I feel a lot safer with them than walking into a shelter where I don't know any of these other people and what risk they might pose.
Right. And so the alternative there in that situation is to build a relationship and trust with those people who have formed their own communities of encampments around the island that self-police each other and survive very well with each other and build from there. There's a tiny house movement that's sweeping the nation that actually, you know, that are mobile and could work for certain types of encampments. Because they're mobile, if there's a development coming on, nearing in that area, you can always move the encampment. The idea, of course, is to eventually move them into permanent shelter. But you have to work with the people where they're at, and that's the important thing.
Matthew, I saw you shake your head a little bit there.
But, and I mean, I think Bert asked a great question, and it is the key question every community asks. How do we help the people who face the most significant challenges? And the focus needs to be on the permanent housing. And for the people that Bert was describing, permanent supportive housing is a proven model for ending their homeless permanently.
But he's saying that they've talked to this one chap, for example, who says, yep. Not going.
But he was referring to shelter. So we need to focus on what is the permanent housing that we're trying to link people to and facilitate their access to, and identifying that or recognizing that every individual may have a very different path towards that housing opportunity. And we need to have a system that's flexible enough to allow people to navigate the path that makes sense for them, to make choices, to put them in charge of the choices that they're making, to not put a lot of barriers or requirements or restrictions in their way, but to design the path that's most efficient and effective for them. And supportive housing needs to be operated with housing first principles, so that it is screening in the people who are going to have the greatest challenges and then identifying the ways to help them be successful in that housing. And it needs to be supported by really intensive and coordinated outreach and engagement activities so that we can develop the relationships, the understanding of people, the understanding of what their goals and dreams are for themselves, and the relationship and trust that they know that an opportunity that's being offered to them is a real opportunity that can be followed through on.
We've got a lot of callers on the line. A lot of people want to get in on this conversation. If that includes you, make sure you call us sooner rather than later. 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, use that number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Doug, calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Doug. Thanks for your patience.
Hello.
Hi there.
Okay, yeah. I'm liking the conversation so far. You know, the problem with homelessness actually covers a number of issues. Your guests are talking about how we treat the homeless, and I'm a little offended that we're talking about the homeless like they're not in the room. You know, they don't have radios, they don't have opinions. But that's a side point. The other issues in homelessness are why is there so much homelessness? And after the passing of these bills, how do we get public policy like this? You know, we live in a town that has incredible tourist industry kind of economy. And, you know, I look to the contributions of the people supporting Bill 52, and just those supporting the bill, $57,000 were contributed by those supporters to Mayor Caldwell. Over $700,000 of the people supporting Bill 42.
Doug, excuse me for having to interrupt you, but we're having a really difficult time with your line, and we've got a lot of interference. If you want to try to call us back, we will try to get you back on with that. So, you know, he's saying that maybe the way that we're talking about people who are homeless isn't in a way fair because they're not in the room with us. But I will tell you, we've had people who are homeless who have called us on this program and who have said much of what we've been talking about tonight in terms of, you know, some of why they don't go into shelters or why they would go into a Housing First program. And over time, we have heard, in fact, from people who are homeless. So, Doug, if you can call us back, we'll see if we can get a better line for you. Going now to James calling us from Kailua. Aloha, James. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha, Bethann. Yeah, hi. My question is in relation to, I guess, rules and shelter. It is my understanding that those individuals that actually go through shelter or programs and the rules that are actually set forth are actually beneficial to them to actually transition out of homelessness and into permanent supportive housing. And I guess also in regards to the Sand Island initiative, I'm hearing words being interchanged. So I hear the words internment camp. I hear the words tent facility, but at the same time, I also hear the city constantly saying transitional center as if it was a structure. So I'm, as a community member, I'm actually very confused by the misuse of words and by constantly positioning shelters and rules and transitional centers as something that's really bad when in relation it's actually helped.
All right, good point. In the conversation, there are sometimes slippage or words about it, but the idea that people would have to come in with their own tents if they're going to be going to Sand Island, that's part of it, and that it is going to be something that has, what at least at the outset, so we're told, a two-year lifespan.
I think I'd like to clarify that, you know, not all shelters have, you know, bad policies or, you know, have, you know, all shelters suffer from goods and bads. So there's great things about IHS and Next Step and Lighthouse. And there's also the negative side, too. Any institution will have its ups and downs. What we've been hearing from houseless persons is that there are valid reasons why they do not want to be in shelter, and we respect that. We honor that, we recognize it, and we keep that, and we advocate for their right to not want to go back. And so you have to respect that process and work with the person where they are and try to find the best path to permanent housing, as Matthew has stated. Everybody is going to be different. You know, shelter works for some. Shelter works for and doesn't work for others. That's just the facts of life.
Jenny, I know that Catherine just mentioned Next Step. Originally, Next Step was supposed to be just a temporary situation.
Right. I think that's one of the big, one of the many concerns with the Sand Island encampment. I'm trying to use a fairly neutral term here, I suppose. But these type of encampments or that have organically developed, unless they're shut down in the city, they usually do not end up being quite that temporary. So Next Step was opened in 2006 as a temporary shelter, and it continues to serve what sadly is a critical need in our community to provide shelter space. So when we hear, oh, it's a year, it's 18 months, it's 2 years, the lease is up to 3 years, there's a huge risk of this becoming a quasi-permanent solution out on Sand Island. And at the same time, it is detracting energy and momentum and resources from both Housing First, so putting everybody experiencing homelessness in permanent housing, as well as the creation of more affordable housing, in addition to the many poverty-related issues that we face here. So I think that we have to be very careful with the language that we're using here, because we don't have a lot of clear information. The parameters are not set, and it's frustrating to be unable, because that means we end up struggling when we try to discuss this and make policy as well. So
I agree, and I'd like to just expand on that. If you don't have a clear idea of what this facility is going to be like and how it's going to be run, you run the risk of doing damage to human beings that are going to be coerced into staying there. And the reason why I say coerced in this harkens back onto the last question. The reason why I call this facility a de facto internment camp is only because of the recent criminalization laws that have made it almost impossible for a houseless person to exist in public spaces, including Waikiki, and soon to be in certain commercial districts across Honolulu. Now, in practice, what this means is that houseless people will be given a few choices and a few choices only. Either we'll take your stuff and put you in jail, or you can choose to either go into shelter or go to Sand Island, and that is coercive in practice, which is why I call this facility a de facto internment camp.
I saw you shake your head on that one, too.
I don't know if I shook my head or nodded, but I wanted to jump back to the question that I think there is a key role for shelter within a Housing First system, and I don't want to indicate that there's not a role that all of these kinds of programs need to be playing, that in many communities they've started to think about shelter as interim housing or bridge housing, so that it's clearly communicating the sense that this is just a short-term way station on that individual or family's path to permanent housing, and it's not an endpoint in and of itself, and that every part of the system really needs to be focusing on how is my interaction, my intervention with you today helping expedite your path to permanent housing. But if we want to implement Housing First pathways, then those shelters need to be low barrier, low expectations, so that people have the opportunity as soon as they say, I'm ready to come inside to your shelter, that there aren't additional barriers and boundaries put in front of them, that the willingness to come in is the only requirement to come in.
As you know of the Sand Island plan, do you feel that that has any part in Housing First?
I can't see that the Sand Island plan is aligned with Housing First principles. It's not focused on creating quicker pathways for people out of homelessness. It's not focused on putting people in charge of making decisions related to the services that they want to pursue. It doesn't seem to be focused on the client-centered, person-centered choices and voluntary services model that is really key to the Housing First approach.
If you're just joining us, we're taking a look at what's happening with the homeless. It was a pretty intense week last week, and we're looking at whether the city's plan is a good one. We want to hear from you. Some good things that have happened, some not so good things. We want to hear how you're assessing how the city is coping with those who are houseless, and whether you think this syncs up well with what you see happening on the level of the state. Around our table tonight, we have Jenny Lee, the staff attorney at the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, Catherine Jian, the executive director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, and Matthew Doherty is in town again. He's the director of initiatives for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Going now to Curtis, calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Curtis. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that permanent housing and affordable housing is kind of a bait and switch. The only thing the state's really interested in is increased tourist dollars. Everything else is just not funded well. So the eviction-based mentality of the landlords, when people, they get finally into the housing with mental ill programs and stuff like that, is predominant here because of the accelerated seller's market. Now, I hope we can change something, too. Because if we gear up all the people in our country with programs and send them to North Korea, they could teach those people how to use programs, and maybe the world can grow together. But otherwise, it's just really a bummer, this whole situation.
All right, Curtis, thanks very much for your call. We're going to go now to Malachi calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Malachi. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, great show. Couple of things. Number one, I witnessed the brutal sweep last week at Kaka'ako, where people's belongings were just swept away. And I talked to one woman who really had a nice tent, a little outdoor kitchen, a place to read. And because she got there late, everything was crushed and put in the garbage truck. And she said, I am not homeless. I am houseless. This is my home. And I think a lot of people feel that way. A second point is talking about the distribution of wealth is that living wage would go a long way to getting people to afford market housing or even subsidized housing. I have a friend who works full-time and gets overtime in a warehouse, night shift, and makes minimum wage. He cannot afford to rent any kind of apartment. So there's a lot of stuff going on there.
And the point being is that none of this is existing on its own. It has to be part of a continuum. Matthew, I mean, we've had these kinds of conversations before, that you can't just simply get somebody into housing first and then hopefully get them together, those people who, you know, can hopefully get their lives moving, those who have just hit a really bad bump and they just need to have some help, and then not have a really viable alternative for them when it comes to affordable housing. What's the bridge in there that you see in other places that we might be able to import here?
Yep. Well, I think as the caller indicated, that the focus on employment services and helping people develop real career pathways so that they can begin to increase their financial self-sufficiency, advance.
But this one's working overtime and people who do that who make $50,000 and couldn't find a place.
And fundamentally, most communities need an expanded supply of affordable housing, and that as a country, we have a deficit of affordable housing opportunities for people who are low income. In many communities, though, even with in tight rental markets, expensive rental markets, through the application of more effective strategies, more focus on aligning the way that resources are being used, they still, even despite those challenges, are making more progress than we're seeing here locally. So I think it's a mix of recognizing that that's a huge obstacle, but that there still are likely opportunities within the housing market to help more people who are currently experiencing homelessness to access housing, to find stability, and then to include employment services and the ability of people to grow their incomes from that basis of stability. And we're pleased, if I can just add, we're pleased right now that the chair of the United States Interagency Council is Secretary Perez of the Department of Labor, and we're starting to explore more strategies for how can we connect some of the mainstream workforce programs to support the ability of people who are experiencing homelessness or have recently exited homelessness to make advances in their employment.
For a national strategy, and as you are looking at all of that, then there's Hawaii. And we can hear some of you people who are listening to us saying, well, that sounds great for the nation, but what's going to happen in Hawaii? Because we've been dealing with this one for, I can't tell you how long we've had conversations on Town Square about where's the affordable housing and what does the word affordable really mean? We've had people here saying even if you're making $50,000 or $70,000, you could still find yourself unable to find affordable housing and also be able to live and feed yourself and pay your utilities and not necessarily, you know, live more than just above survival.
Yeah. And we need investments into the full range of housing opportunities. So we need the expanded investments into permanent supportive housing for people who are experiencing chronic homelessness. And we need increased investments into affordable housing for people who are struggling with lower incomes, who have exited homelessness and don't need the intensity of services but do need that long-term affordable housing option.
We've got Rick calling us from the Windward side. Aloha, Rick. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I've wanted to raise here all my life, and I'm just so sick and tired of hearing about affordable housing. It never happens. So basically, you know, the definition of bourgeoisie in the Webster Dictionary is, you know, your net worth is based on the value of the land you own. So when people's, you know, when the property values go up, everybody's all happy. But what it does is drive up the property values for everybody and nobody can afford it. So how do you deal with that? The economic system is based on class division. Anyway, bye-bye.
All right, Rick, thank you. I mean, some of what he's talking about, I mean, obviously this is well integrated. It's nothing that's going to happen where you only fix this part of it and the rest of it's going to just fall in line too. But we keep coming back to the whole issue of really what is affordable housing for people who are making $30,000, who are making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, and who haven't been able to find it, and what kind of housing opportunities do we have around that, and will we see anyone avail himself of those? 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. We're looking at homelessness. It was quite a week last week for those who are homeless, and with the passage of the sit-lay bills and looking at the Sand Island plan that looks like it's on a track, at least until the Department of Health weighs in. There's still the issue that there are some problems with what's out there on Sand Island, and we don't know whether this is going to be stopped or not by the Department of Health. Have either of you, Jenny Lee or Catherine Jan, heard anything from anyone suggesting that the Department of Health may just put a roadblock to this?
Before I get into that, I'd like to thank the last two callers for raising the issue of the economy and economic justice, because economic justice is a point that our state has not really dialogued about thoroughly. We need to start talking about economic justice and wealth distribution, because people are suffering, and there's no excuse to have a man work a full-time job overtime, work his tail off, and not be able to afford housing himself and just eke by without being able to amass the wealth that it takes to raise a family, to rest assured that the rug won't be pulled out from under him during retirement, and fall into homelessness. And, you know, we live in a state of haves and have-nots, unfortunately. And unless we start talking seriously about economic justice, you know, the people will still be – he's right. Affordable housing will just be this flashy catchphrase during election time that never will be fulfilled for the average person that is just struggling to get by. I don't know what it's going to take, but we really need to start focusing our priorities on – solutions that actually work. Innovate. We need to innovate our housing market. We need to bridle the tourism economy, because sometimes they can be wrong and very culturally offensive in their actions and their lobbying tactics in, say, trying to criminalize the most vulnerable, the homeless population in Waikiki, and scapegoat them for the demise of our economy, which is completely a fallacy.
Well, if not just the demise, but being able to see that that may not necessarily work well for them when they have a business and they have homeless people who are around their business. I mean, do you allow at all that those people who have businesses are greatly concerned by not having a place where a tourist can feel free to walk in and not feel like there's going to be certain things that might greet him or her at the doorstep.
You know, what struck me as odd, being from Hawaii, fourth generation here, and I'm sure, there are many people who feel this way. Instead of taking the rise of homelessness in Waikiki as a sign that maybe something is a little bit amiss about how we're doing things economically here, instead of questioning why are there growing numbers of homelessness in Waikiki and across the state, instead of stopping and saying, what can I do to fix this? How can I contribute to our government to be able to make sure that everybody survives? They instead say, let's just get these people out of sight. Now, that's morally, ethically, and spiritually wrong in my book, because you can't continue that behavior and expect the economy to get better. The only way the economy will get better is that if everybody survives economically and has the basic standard of living. That's the key.
All right, we've got a lot of callers on the line, and we will try to get everyone through as we can. Going now to Don calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Don.
Hey, good afternoon. Hi. I have a question. Has the mayors in the state of Hawaii adopted the First Lady's Mayor's Initiative?
The caller's referring to the Mayor's Challenge to End Veterans Homelessness, which to date Mayor Caldwell has not signed on for the Mayor's Challenge. There are more than 200 mayors and other elected officials across the country who have stepped up and said that they're making the commitment to do what they can to make sure that their community achieves the goal of ending veterans homelessness by the end of 2015.
But that's strictly targeted toward veterans.
It specifically is focused on veterans, with the idea that we have seen investments into the programs that can serve veterans, that we've been able to get the federal allocations of those resources, and that if we can use making progress and ending veterans homelessness as a proof point that homelessness is not intractable, it's not unsolvable, that we can apply the same kinds of strategies for the other people who are experiencing homelessness. And it's not a sequential process. It's trying to make progress on all populations and address families with children, address chronically homeless persons, by recognizing that we have a unique opportunity to end veterans homelessness, and that unique opportunity can then be leveraged to try to advance even more progress for other people.
Yeah, she stated on June 3rd, I think it was, at the White House that she would her plan is to house all veterans by next year.
Yep.
I would suggest that the mayors on the state of Hawaii go to the U.S. Vets Initiative and look at the model there and maybe implement it on the state of the people that aren't veterans for this project they have at Star Island. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for the call. Going now to Elehu calling us from Kualoa. Did I get that right?
Yeah. My question is, Housing First, I read about it a few years ago in Washington that there were no rules where these guys go off the street, they can just move in with no rules, they can drink and smoke or whatever, and is that the case here with this Housing First?
Okay, let's sort of get some real parameters there. All right, thanks so much.
Okay.
Matthew, very,
sure.
Very briefly.
So when we talk about Housing First and permanent supportive housing using Housing First principles, the goal is to get people into housing with few barriers to their entry so that they don't have to try to solve all of their problems and challenges before they get access to housing, but the housing becomes the basis of stability. I wouldn't say there's no rules, that the model works where it's the same rights and responsibilities as any tenant renting in the market. So if I was to rent a unit in the private market in Honolulu, I'd be signing a lease. That lease would spell out what I was required to do to maintain my tenancy. That's how permanent supportive housing should operate, but it should operate with the same kinds of conditions that would be put on any renter in the private market. So a responsibility to pay rent, a responsibility to be a good neighbor, a responsibility to not cause undue damage to the unit. And it's the focus is on helping provide the services and supports that allow those tenants to be good tenants and to live up to the terms and conditions of their lease, and then to engage them into services that address their needs, their goals, their challenges, but putting them at the center of the decision-making process about which services are going to be best equipped to address what they're trying to focus on.
And not necessarily with disclosure that this person is part of Housing First.
Correct. There shouldn't be a requirement to notify
everybody is treated the same, and no one knows who is part of Housing First, if they are or not.
Yep. And with the vision that we are, the goal is to really integrate people back into communities and to have them be community members just like the rest of us are community members, so that we all are being treated the same and being given the same rights and held to the same responsibilities.
All right. Going now to Brian calling us from Waipahu. Aloha, Brian. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Talking about the economic model that is like almost impossible to have housing here in Hawaii. Well, you know, the Filipino community is, for especially the first generation, it will be difficult. But at the end of the day, I see all these Filipinos who basically got homes, and you know, they had to work two or three jobs, and but at the end of the day, they made it to the point where the families here are surviving, and the future generation is basically making it. I mean, people are just going to have to adjust to a different model. I would suggest you look at the Asian community, especially the Filipinos, how they can make it in Hawaii with no high school or college degrees, but the rest of the Americans born and raised in the U.S. cannot. I find that very odd.
Brian, thanks very much for the call. You've raised the point about, doesn't this come down to sort of personal industriousness? You've heard that argument before. I'm looking at you, Catherine Jean, and also to Jenny Lee about this, that when we see immigrants who come and who are able to do whatever it is they have to do to be able to make it, are they somehow better poised or better motivated to be able to create a life? And that, as Brian is suggesting, that those of us who are born and raised in the United States somehow shy away from everything you would have to do to be able to create a life for yourself.
I'd caution people from making generalized statements about pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality, because you only see what you see. I work with trafficking victims. A lot of them are from the Philippines and Asia, other parts of Asia, and they are continually stuck in a cycle of poverty. And they're trafficked in by their own people who, you know, there are few that actually subsist on the exploitation of their labor. They look like successful business people, have families, and thrive. But beneath them are hundreds, if not thousands, of workers who are exploited and stuck in the paradigm of poverty that's set up for them. So you can't really say categorically that Asians have worked their way up to the top and we should follow their lead.
All right. We're going to go back now to Doug, who is back with us and hopefully on a better line. Doug, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Can you hear me now?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question for your guest. And that is that Hawaii is unique in that it has a very powerful tourist industry lobby. And if I ran the supporters of Bill 42 through the contribution database, and they had contributed more than $57,000 to Mayor Caldwell, and in fact had contributed more than $700,000 to other state and county politicians. So how do we neutralize that kind of power?
That's a very big question, and it goes back to a lot of people who would like to know what contributions are made and how do you follow the money. That's a whole other conversation that we have had on the show and will again have. But looking at the linkage between those who support someone with a plan and the plan that they like, you may not like it, but certainly those who are supporting it like it. You're going to get that no matter what side you're on with it. But I promise you we can take up that conversation another time, especially as we are in an election year. Going now to John calling us from Pearl City. Aloha,
hi,
John.
Hi. I work in the Sand Island area. I've worked there for over 30 years and mostly at night, too. I've talked to many homeless people, and when a lot of them, if not most of them that I've talked to, when you really get to know them, they're mentally ill, and they're mistrusting of every organization, especially government. How do you help those people?
This sort of harkens back to a question we had earlier in the hour. All right, who of you wants to take it on this time?
I guess what I would say, and thank you for bringing up your personal experiences and talking to folks and learning more about their situations. But we do have these evidence-based models now. We know what has been successful, that there have been dramatic reductions in many jurisdictions around homelessness by placing people as quickly as possible into permanent housing and then providing them with the appropriate supportive services. And this is the direction that earlier this year, the city, both the mayor and the city council, and the state has also been funding these approaches. We have selected this as a matter of policy, and that's why diverting this attention back to diverting it towards Sand Island, diverting money, $500,000 out of $3 million that we have to provide these kind of interventions that we know will work, is just incredibly misguided and takes us away from the type of things that will actually help the folks that you're speaking to.
Is there someone that you feel is not at all able to be helped in this way, whether it's with Housing First or not? I mean, do we have to get to a point of understanding that we are not going to be able to help everybody?
No, I don't believe that. I think everybody has an opportunity to be successful in permanent housing, and that we need as communities to continue to innovate and find those solutions, rely on the practices that are proven to work, to the approaches that Jenny was describing are demonstrated by research to be effective for those people who have the most significant barriers. And the key part on the front end is that outreach and engagement, that trusting relationship, that putting people in charge of their decisions so that they know that it's a path that they are setting for themselves, and that the agencies and programs are there to facilitate them through that path as quickly as possible. That we may need to do outreach and engagement to some individuals over and over and over again until the opportunity that's being presented to them is an opportunity that they're saying yes to. But as communities, we can get to those opportunities and we can achieve these goals.
Your point is that there's never a point of saying you can't be helped.
Correct. And I'm not willing to give up on anybody. That I think we as communities need to commit ourselves to making those opportunities available.
So here we are. We're coming to the end of the hour, and we've come through the last week or so. We don't know whether or not Sand Island will be a plan that will go forward or not. Meanwhile, we also heard about Pauahihale and the idea that there are going to be bathrooms and accessible showers and personal space there for people who need it coming in and out. Where do you see more plans like that fitting into this? And because clearly that's not Housing First either. So looking at it as only, are we only going to focus on Housing First issues, or do we also need to build in some of the other issues like we've seen happen or as planned with Pauahihale?
I think there are options around that, because we do continue to be in a state effectively of a crisis around homelessness. And we know that this is not, there is no quick fix. We talk about affordable housing, economic injustice, community-based mental health services. The list goes on. So there is a need to be genuinely compassionate and address the needs of people who right now don't have a shelter. So I think keeping those options, things that are actually responsive and help bring people back into the community, help them maintain themselves and also keep their neighbors happy as well. There is a role for that because of where we are right now.
And I think also, just to summarize what I've heard all of the houseless families with children say over and over again at hearings and out there on the streets, is that these policies are being enforced upon them without their dialogue, without their say. And how are you going to work for them and help them if you don't include them in the discourse? That is really important.
Matthew, we'll give you the final word.
Sure. Well, you keep mentioning that it's been an interesting last week. It's also been interesting last week there were two national experts that I've worked with for many years who are here on the ground training providers in the details of the practices of Housing First. And I think the conversation about Housing First has been taking place in Honolulu and Hawaii for many years. But we now need to move from conversation to actual implementation and practice. And last week's training are a great opportunity to actually develop the skills to deliver those services.
Matthew Doherty, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in, Beth Ann. For this visit. We'll talk to you the next time you're here. Catherine John, thank you for coming in, as always. And to Jenny Lee, we appreciate the conversation with you tonight on Town Square. We'll pick up a conversation like this sometime very soon. In the meantime, I will see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.